safety precautions around the COVID-19 coronavirus pandemic have affected a number of our broadcasts, and a repeat program has been selected for the following broadcast.
FM 104.6 Radio Shalom, and we're welcoming Rabbi Brent back to continue talking about the fascinating subject of Maimonides. Thank you, Rabbi Brent. And we left talking about Maimonides' life and how busy he was, and I just wondered, as he was writing all these things, he was a member of the community. Did the Jewish community accept all his writings? I mean, did they revere him and so on? And how did it spread? How did people know about it? Like, they didn't have the internet.
Yeah. Well, his works were disseminated and copied and transmitted and carried to communities throughout the Jewish world. And there is generally an understanding that he was respected and regarded with high esteem for his Jewish knowledge. On the other hand, there were certainly some tensions in the relations he had with at least one person in particular. The acting Gaon was not terribly fond with him.
Disagreed. Not a fan.
No, and disagreed with him on a number of issues. I mean, one of the most prevalent disagreements that arose between the two was a discussion of whether a Jew was permitted to be on a journey at sea over the Sabbath, and whether they could observe the Sabbath while at sea. Traveling during Shabbat is not permitted traditionally. However, Maimonides made a statement that he permitted someone who was on a long sea journey to,
as his brother was,
to be able to have that journey occur during the Sabbath. So, and that got them into a little bit of a war of letters between each other. The other part of him and his acceptance was that he's someone who I mentioned in our last conversation spent time writing both philosophical and halachic, that's Jewish, legalistic ritual works. The Jewish legal works he wrote were, you know, seen as astonishing for their scope and their succinctness, despite criticisms that we mentioned about not bringing into those the sources of his writing. On the other hand, his philosophical writing was somewhat more radical, and you know, this led to an opinion which still can be found in some traditional circles that Jews are only permitted to study the halakhic works of Maimonides, and that the philosophic works are not to be touched. You know, they're asur, they're forbidden.
Well, at that time too, they didn't really like outside influences. They were scared that outside influences would change, and I don't know if it was a power thing that the leaders and the rabbis at the time didn't want, you know, like the Enlightenment to come. And so his ideas of Aristotle and so on would have not been.
There is this challenge between the intellectual elite, so to say, and the masses, for sure. And it's something that Maimonides was very, very acutely aware of when he wrote his Guide for the Perplexed. I joked when we mentioned the guide before and its name, that it's a book that, despite being called the Guide for the Perplexed, can actually leave someone more perplexed upon reading it than before they started.
What's perplexing about it?
It's a very esoteric piece of literature. But beyond that, Maimonides, because he was aware of how controversial many of the statements that he was making was, concealed those statements using
cryptic
methods. Yes.
Like the spies.
Well, yes. I mean, you find he would write multiple times on the same topic in different areas of the Guide for the Perplexed, mm-hmm. and the two times that he would write would contradict each other. And he did it intentionally, trying to confound anyone who was not at a level sufficient enough to be able to understand with maturity the content of what he was trying to convey.
So it was a safeguard.
Yeah, yes, it was a safeguard. Mm-hmm. There were other aspects that made this controversial as well, in that two of the most significant theological doctrines of Judaism, which have very strong mystical corollaries, Maaseh Vereshit, the acts of creation, and Maaseh Merkavah, the account of the divine chariot that's described in Ezekiel, were topics that he wished to be able to discuss in his philosophy. And yet, at the same time, there was a halachic provision that forbid teaching the Maaseh Vereshit, the acts of creation in this mystical sense, to two people. And the a provision also forbade the teaching of Maaseh Merkavah to even one individual.
So who did the forbidding?
These were halachot. These were laws that came through rabbinic literature about what one was permitted to and what one was not permitted to teach. And because the nature of these two works was so controversial in Jewish circles, because of their mystical content that contradicted central doctrines. It's a good question. It's a good question. They're bodies of literature, first of all, so there's multiple writers to both. These were things that were written sometime during the first millennia. There's certainly a lot of rabbinic literature that appears with a certain slant of reading to contradict them. In particular, there's a theory by David Aaron, Professor David Aaron at Hebrew Union College, that the book Bereshit Rabbah, the rabbinic book of approximately the 5th century of the Common Era, was written as a response to these mystical practices on the periphery of mainstream Jewish practice.
That was before Kabbalah?
This was certainly before Kabbalah. Mm. We talk about Kabbalah. That's a practice of the 13th and later centuries.
So was this an early version of it?
Kabbalah takes many of its influences from Merkavah mysticism and from Maaseh Bereshit, for sure. For sure, there's a line of Jewish mysticism that stretches all the way backwards and forwards through Jewish history. And
was that from Svat?
Well, okay. So the story of Kabbalah is complex. Moshe de Leon was the author of the Zohar, and he wrote in northern Spain, actually close to Provence, where some of Maimonides' strongest followers were. The activity around Kabbalah and Sfat was Isaac Luria, who developed this idea of klepot and more complex ideas of mysticism a bit later. There's a differentiation that should be understood between what mysticism does and what philosophy does, mm-hmm. though, because Maimonides was primarily a philosopher, and these mystical texts had an influence on the way that we understand theologically the idea of creation and of God's presence in the world, how God exists in a sphere that is superimposed over reality, sort of in Maaseh Merkava. A mystic, though, attempts to do something different. He's not looking for rational understanding. He's looking primarily to experience and to access these hidden realms that are concealed within nature.
That's not what he was writing about when he was...
No, certainly not. That's later than Maimonides, and the Zohar hadn't been written yet, hadn't been thought about, and Kabbalah was not a topic of discussion either. Those had their influence a bit later in Jewish history.
But I thought that they might have been influenced by Maimonides if he was cryptically...
Well... Yeah, you take philosophy and mysticism. They all both have one key similarity. Actually, it's that both of them look for hidden meanings in the text. The only difference is that when it's philosophy, the hidden meaning they're looking for is a philosophical, intellectual, rational a truth hidden within the text. When you look at mysticism, the thing that's hidden is a mystical, esoteric, occult bit of wisdom. That is, you know, hidden between the layers of the text. So Maimonides was certainly on the philosophic side and not a mystic by any stretch of the imagination.
But philosophy, you can either, you accept it or you don't accept somebody's philosophy, or you agree with some and you disagree with other bits. But how did he must have had some tremendous something to have been the influence that to this day he's revered.
Well, if we were to talk specifically about the Guide for the Perplexed and what was so remarkable about that work, we first have to recognize that in the time that it was written, it was revolutionary. The Guide for the Perplexed introduced an idea that God was non-corporeal, that God had no body, that God couldn't be conceived of in this way at all, as having an image, having a body, having, you know, any of these things. And yet that was a controversial opinion in the time. Still today, and it's now the dominant idea. I mean, Maimonides has won that battle, and the idea that God is non-corporeal is well accepted and regarded within Jewish circles. Part of what the Guide attempts to do, in fact, the main aim of the Guide is to assist individuals who are Jewish, who have learned Jewish practices and have been faithful, and yet because of their knowledge and awareness of philosophy and modern science and disciplines that contain truths that seem to contradict the literal meaning of parts of the Bible and rabbinic literature, he wrote this guide to try to persuade them that it was worthwhile to continue their Jewish practice, and that indeed in all of the Bible and all of rabbinic writing and Jewish thought, there had to be some central point that was coherent and could be accepted as truth. And so this led him to develop certain doctrines, notably about God and about creation and about prophecy, that were hugely influential.
So what he really, Jimmy, did a Reader's Digest.
What's that?
He did a Reader's Digest.
Yes, for these individuals, it was a Reader's Digest that, as we said, was written very cryptically and very confusingly, so that someone who would find the things that he was saying heretical, you know, to say that despite the many times that God is described as having, you know, walking on earth in the Garden of Eden, or sitting on a throne in Exodus, or on a divine chariot as a warrior in Ezekiel, that, you know, God can does not have a body or an image.
Could have been manifestations.
Well, this is not what Maimonides wanted to believe. It could have been, but that's not what he wanted to believe. Part of the reason why these ideas had developed is that we're told that God created man in Genesis, B'Tselem Elohim, in the image of God. And so logically, one would think that if God created man in the image of God, God created man with a body. Therefore, God must have a body as well. Not so. Maimonides devotes a section of his Guide to the Perplexed to demonstrate that this word B'Tselem, in the image of, actually relates more abstractly to the nature of, or to the intellect of man. And so humans are created in the image of God, and that they have the faculties of reason in order to understand the world.
I thought it was the soul.
Well, there's another interesting discussion about the soul. Maimonides actually withdrew criticism for this statement that he made, even in the Mishnah Torah, that he had not clearly stated that the body should be resurrected in the time of the Messiah. He argued and wrote a letter, Gerat Hamidah, trying to say that he did in fact believe that the body would be resurrected, but the book, the Mishnah Torah, talked more directly about the immortality of the soul, which of course is a topic that we know from Greek philosophy to be very well accepted.
So how is it today that there are still study circles studying Maimonides?
He left us a lot to study.
Even in the modern world, it's...
Maimonides, for his time, was very much ahead of the curve. And had a huge influence. At the same time, you know, those interested in studying Maimonides should know that aspects of him certainly reflect his time and not our modern knowledge or values. His understanding of what women's place in society should be is not what we would expect in our era of women's rights and women's suffrage. Other areas, like his practice of medicine, is very much couched in the medical understanding of his time. So he's still talking about the four fluids, the four phlegms that comprise the body, and using medieval techniques to practice medicine, which
is understandable because that was his term. But this is also part of, you know, you say people made commentaries and the discussion and the dialogue is going on through the centuries. But when we look at today with today's knowledge and today's changes so much, how come we don't accept that things have to change? You know, that ideas and concepts that were in those days, you say you halachically wrote down what should be the practice. And this is, they say, this is what you've got to do and this is what you're forbidden to do. But nowadays that can't be relevant because we don't accept so easily anymore to be told what is forbidden and what you can do and what you can't do.
It depends what primacy you give Jewish law. And certainly there are many, many Jews who still follow traditional Jewish law. Orthodox communities, certainly aspects of even liberal Judaism, Masorti Judaism, conservative Judaism, considers itself to be a halachic movement and places a huge value on being able to look at the history of Jewish practice and to show how their contemporary practice develops from that. It's not so much changing. Changing implies that something was wrong. Well, the word that they would use is unfolding.
Right.
Is unfolding, that halacha unfolds throughout the ages, and that Maimonides' code, as wonderful as it was, the Mishneh Torah, it was not the last code written. There were criticisms and commentaries written on his Mishneh Torah. And later, codes were written to supersede his Mishneh Torah, the Arba Turim, and then the Shulchan Aruch, even later than that. We still have these codes and these guides being written today.
So do you have to be a certain eminence for your words to count? You know, are there people, maybe because they spend time on philosophy and studying and so on, whose words mean more than others? Because if you're writing commentaries, everybody has an opinion. I mean, if you now look in the internet, everybody's writing their commentaries all the time. So,
mm-hmm.
How would it affect today?
Well, it depends on how you understand the importance of the author. And this was one of the major reasons why the criticism of Maimonides' Mishneh Torah was so significant, was that you could see who a particular author was and then know that another author of either more or less importance wrote a different opinion. And you could choose on the basis of how well you regarded the knowledge of those individuals which one to follow. We have the same thing today. There certainly is a plethora of things being written about Judaism, about Jewish practice, about Jewish mysticism, Jewish philosophy, about the Bible. And we have to, as we look at these, be a bit skeptical in looking at the author and the source and knowing that we trust the source as someone who has done the proper work ahead of time to be considered an authority on it. Maimonides' knowledge was vast, and his renown for being a true scholar of Jewish literature was regarded to be the foremost of his time, if not the foremost of all time.
So it is still relevant today.
Yeah, it is still relevant. And those wishing to know how to navigate a particular issue can still get onto the internet and search for the Mishneh Torah and find Maimonides' discussion and presentation of the different rules that are to be followed when it comes to Jewish practice.
And then you can write your commentary on it, like Facebook.
Sure.
Well, that was a precious time. But in what way do you think his influence was so great? Was it because when people read it, they thought about it and commented on it, or because it was, there were so many truths in it that had to be accepted?
Maimonides' Mishneh Torah, as we've already discussed, was the predecessor for the greatest regarded halakha code, the Shulchan Aruch, which is still today, in terms of the most comprehensive code of Jewish law, studied and referred to often. It's one of the prominent books that you'll find on a rabbi's bookshelf. In terms of his philosophy, his philosophical orientation was a huge influence to people like Baruch Spinoza, who later wrote essentially a Jewish theology that talked about God as being a natural force within the world. And also Maimonides was a huge influence on the early reformers with his philosophy that Reformed Judaism, as it developed first in Western Germany, was strongly influenced by Maimonides. And you know, Abraham Geiger is an example, spent a huge amount of time studying the philosophical works of Maimonides. He didn't care so much about the halachic works. That wasn't his interest. We take Maimonides' understanding of starting with the idea of a non-corporeal God, moving into an idea that the Bible presents some essentially stories that can be seen as representative of philosophical steps. I mean, Maimonides will say every time that Moses ascends Mount Sinai, it's not that he physically ascended Mount Sinai, it's that he achieved a higher intellectual level so that he could come into more direct contact with God. And by the way, God envisioned as an Aristotelian God is the first cause and the prime mover from which the matter of the universe gains its substance.
That makes sense.
I think it can be a profound help to individuals who are struggling today to reconcile religious beliefs with science.
If you don't take it literally.
Well, he takes it literally, but he takes it literally in the sense that he's looking for the philosophical underpinnings of the Bible. And he's understanding the Bible according to a dictum that the Bible speaks in human language. It couches itself in images and in terms that we, with our meager intellects, not comparable to God's in any sense, can understand and take comfort from. But in fact, God does not have a form. God does not have the content attributed to him through the Bible or her through the Bible. I'll give you an example. Actually, his early writings, the commentary on the Mishnah, Maimonides lists the 13 principles that Jews are supposed to believe at a minimum, and amongst these is the resurrection of the dead, something that I also mentioned he'd gained criticism from for not seeming to hold a traditional enough belief in its truth. For Maimonides, the idea of resurrection, he refers to a statement in the Talmud that says for the wicked, it's as though they are dead when they are alive, and for the righteous, it is as though they are alive even when they are dead, that their lips, when they're spoken of, move in the grave. And so with this, the idea of immortality, the immortality of the soul, the resurrection, the fact that we can take the great lessons from earlier generations and use those in our lives today for good, and that's momentous. When we remember the good work and the good deeds and the things that the people did before us to make our world a better place, we bring them life, we bring them immortality, we resurrect their memories, and we bring them blessing.
Thank you, Rabbi. That was a very good note to end on. And thank you very much, and thank you for listening. Don't forget to listen next Sunday at 10 past 10. And if you've missed this program, you can go to www.planetaudio.org.nz/Radio Shalom. One word.